From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Officials in Sutherland Springs, Texas, say church shooter Devin Kelly did not have a license to carry a gun, but owned four firearms. They're describing the mass murder as part of a domestic situation because Kelly sent threatening text messages to his former mother-in-law, who was a member of the First Baptist Church. But she was not at services yesterday when Kelly killed 26 people there, many of them children. After firing, Kelly fled the church. An armed resident chased him. Freeman Martin with the Texas Public Safety Department described what happened next.
During that pursuit, the suspect used his cell phone to notify his father that he had been shot and didn't think he was going to make it. Subsequently, he shot himself.
Well, joining us now with more is David Brown, host of the show Texas Standard at KUT in Austin. He's in Sutherland Springs. Hi there, David.
Hello there, Meghna.
Well, first of all, what more can you tell us about what authorities are saying about this being a domestic situation? Have they described it beyond that?
Well, you know, not a lot. And to be honest, that's something that really does strike you if you've reported from some of these incidents that they've become more frequent, as has been discussed in great detail in the past several hours. Officials here are being very tight-lipped about who was actually injured, what the scale of these casualties are. In fact, we only learned just a few hours ago that the youngest among the victims was just 18 months old, the oldest a 77-year-old man. So we're still learning bits and pieces about how this all happened, but the shooter is identified as Devin Patrick Kelly, and he is said to have been wearing black tactical gear and a ballistics vest, and he was carrying a Ruger AR-style rifle when he entered the church yesterday. There have been conflicting accounts over whether that was actually firing on the church from outside or whether he started shooting inside. But an interesting development within the past several minutes, we are hearing that there was a video from inside the church and that Texas law enforcement officials are reviewing that video right now.
I see. A video because the church recorded its services regularly or some
apparently
other kind of video?
Apparently so, and we're not clear on that. There was a security camera, or what appeared to be a security camera, that was visible from outside of the structure. Last night, after the vigil that was held here, To be honest, the place just cleared out. People are still grieving, and they are feeling, they're in such pain, frankly. Yeah. They don't want to talk to reporters. And so they went into their homes, turned off their lights. The only lights you could see in this tiny little one stoplight town, you know, it was the Klieg lights that were focused on the church as the reporters, maybe more reporters here than residents, were doing stand-ups. Everyone asking the same question, why did it happen? And all that we are hearing so far is a little that I think you've been sharing with your listeners there, Meghna, that there appears to have been some sort of domestic family dispute. The in-laws apparently attended this church, but were not attending yesterday. Mm.
Now, we're also seeing that Kelly had been discharged from the Air Force for bad conduct. What more do we know about that?
Well, this is interesting because it's not clear that bad conduct is necessarily a dishonorable discharge. Now, the way that the gun laws work, if you have been dishonorably discharged, it's seen as the equivalent of a felony, and it's difficult to get clearance for when you're trying to purchase a handgun or a rifle. We are hearing from alcohol, tobacco, and firearms officials that this gun was purchased at a local major retail store in San Antonio. And it was apparently that transaction took place in 2016. Now, what we're hearing is that if he had a dishonorable discharge, we're also hearing a bad conduct discharge, which is slightly different, he would not have been eligible to make that purchase under law. And in fact, he also had a record of a domestic abuse record. That, too, would have come up as a red flag. Texas officials refused to issue him a license to carry in this state because there were so many red flags. But apparently, when this Ruger rifle was purchased at a San Antonio store, those red flags didn't go up.
Oh, interesting. So he couldn't get the license to carry, but could still purchase the firearm. Okay. So I imagine that
appears to be
that
right.
These are the areas in which investigators are going to continue to be looking at as they try to figure out how and why this happened.
For sure, but this raises so many other issues. It raises issues, we've just talked about domestic violence, and we don't know the scope or scale or the details of that, and so we're having to talk around that. There are obviously issues of mental health that are invoked here. There's the gun debate, and frankly, people here, they don't want to hear anything about guns. They're very suspicious of the media descending on them and begging them for stories. And frankly, that gets to the issue number four here, grief. I mean, who helps these folks through this sort of trauma? This is a very poor part of Texas. You know, we talk a lot about flyover country in the U.S. This is kind of flyover Texas in a way. You know, this isn't the West Texas that's romanticized. This isn't the big booming cities. This is in the shadow of that boom. And these are a lot of poor folks. And they really rely on faith. When Governor Abbott, I mean, the church is such an important part of this community. Mm. And to have that place violated, that really does cut to the core of so many of these people. And when Governor Abbott speaks about, you know, leaning on the rock and leaning on faith, that has genuine resonance for so many people down here. It's not just pushing aside the gun issue or any of these other issues. Yeah. Right now, these people are truly grieving, and it's hard to overstate just the kind of impact this huge tragedy has had on such a small community.
Mm. Well, David Brown is host of the show Texas Standard on KUT in Austin, speaking to us from Sutherland Springs today. David, thank you.
Thank you, Magda.
Well, President Trump has been responding to the news from Texas while on his trip to Asia. The president called the shooting a mental health problem, not a gun problem. Back in Washington, there was another big story over the weekend, the leak of a massive trove of documents called the Paradise Papers. Those documents provided detailed information about how companies and wealthy individuals put millions of dollars into offshore tax havens. They also revealed that Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross has retained an interest in a shipping firm called Navigator Holdings, which has connections to a Russian oligarch and also to the son-in-law of Russian President Vladimir Putin. NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving joins us now. And Ron, there have been claims that Ross did not properly disclose this. He says that's not true. Is there anything illegal about what we've learned here?
Maybe not in his ownership in the first place, Jeremy, but there have been sanctions on Russia going back years, back to its first annexation of Crimea and its other incursions into Ukraine. So that needs to be looked at to see what this particular shipping firm, Navigator Holdings, has been up to and when. And apparently, according to the Paradise Papers, Wilbur Ross had something between $2 million and $10 million invested in this firm. So there are going to be questions about why all this was not previously known. Was it concealed illegally, or at least in violation of the rules of Congress? Should it have been in Wilbur Ross's previous disclosures of his interests? Did someone in the Trump operation think that any business ties to any relatives or business associates of Vladimir Putin might look bad, be a political problem for the president? Those are some of the questions that have been raised.
And meanwhile, former Trump campaign manager Paul Manafort and his protege Rick Gates appeared in court this morning for a bail hearing, both indicted last week. Yesterday, news organizations, including the New York Times, reported that special counsel Robert Mueller has enough evidence to also indict Michael Flynn and his son. He was the national security advisor until Trump fired him. Do you expect another shoe to drop in the Russia case this week?
It could be this week, but it is not necessarily this week. Mueller might have reason to wait with that particular brace of indictments, if that's what's next, or even to delay them now that word of them has appeared in the media. So there are other stories roiling, and it's conceivable the special prosecutor will hold his fire. But if the question is the ripeness of the Michael Flynn case, there's every reason to think it is ripe. And up until this week, or a week ago, when the Manafort indictment came down, the betting was about even as to which Trump associates would be the first to face indictments, either Manafort and his deputy or former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn and his son.
Ron, tomorrow is Election Day, and we've been watching a couple of races, including this very tight race for governor in Virginia. Over the weekend, a New York Times Siena College poll gave the Democratic candidate Ralph Northam a 3-point lead over his Republican challenger, Ed Gillespie. What are you expecting in Virginia, and is it a referendum on President Trump?
The polls have been all over the map in this race, Jeremy. Some showing Northam way ahead for a while, some showing it quite close, so at least one showing it a tie. The one thing that's clear is that Northam started out with a big lead, and that big lead seems to have evaporated. Ed Gillespie, the Republican nominee, was weak in the primary, barely beating a challenger on his right who was much closer to the Tea Party and to Trump Republicans. Since then, though, Gillespie has done everything he could to appeal to those voters, to get them enthused. He was talking about keeping Confederate statues in place and getting people concerned about sanctuary cities to engage in this particular election. So that has been the issue that has driven the upward movement for Ed Gillespie. Meanwhile, Northam has been a rather colorless candidate, has had trouble keeping the focus on Trump, and instead he's had a lot of the Democratic voter divisions over a number of these same issues reemerge.
All right. Well, we will keep an eye on what happens in Virginia and New Jersey. By the way, it's losing all the attention to Virginia right now. Not quite as close of a race, perhaps. Ron Elving, NPR Senior Washington Editor and Correspondent, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Republicans are continuing their push for tax cuts after releasing details of their plan last week. Some Republicans, though, aren't ready to vote for the plan. Yesterday on NBC's Meet the Press, Senator James Lankford of Oklahoma said that he may vote against the plan if it increases the debt too much.
I'm actually not comfortable with increasing the debt. This is something that's been a behind-the-scenes conversation for a long time. It's one thing to be able to cut taxes. It's another thing to be able to say, how are we going to deal with our debt and deficit?
Others are more confident that tax cuts will go through. Here's House Speaker Paul Ryan speaking yesterday on Fox News Sunday.
We have to have tax reform. We have to have tax cuts for people in the middle. This delivers that, and we really are convinced this is going to help get our economy growing and reaching its potential. You have to do this in order to do that, and that's why we want to get it done this year so we can have a very good 2018 and get stronger economic growth. And so, yes, we're on track for moving this through the House before Thanksgiving. That's our plan. We expect our friends in the Senate to be about a week behind us.
Economists, policymakers, and business owners, meanwhile, are trying to sift through what kind of impact the tax plan might have. Joining us now is former U.S. Secretary of the Treasury Larry Summers, who served in the Clinton and Obama administrations. He's also President Emeritus of Harvard University. Secretary Summers, welcome back.
Glad to be with you.
And you say that this plan will harm growth, which is the opposite of what's being promised. Why do you think it will harm economic growth?
Mainly because the increase in the budget deficit that will result will mean higher interest rates, which will discourage investment. Secondarily, because the design of the plan will likely increase various inefficiencies between different types of capital by encouraging various kinds of tax shelters.
Explain. What are you talking about there?
So the proposal will cut taxes very substantially on passively owned businesses that already don't pay the corporate tax. That's the so-called pass-through provision, which will operate primarily to increase tax shelter investments, and by increasing tax shelter investments, reduce the efficiency with which capital is allocated. You know, from the point of view of how the economy performs, it depends on two things. It depends on how much investment there is, and it depends on how productive the investment is. This bill may well reduce investment by increasing interest rates. That's the budget deficit aspect. And it may well reduce the productivity of investment by encouraging tax shelters, by cutting the taxes on tax shelters.
And on your first point about the increase in the deficit, we're talking about a $1.5 trillion increase in debt over 10 years. You think that that actually could harm growth by pushing the Fed to raise interest rates further?
I think it will both push the Fed to raise interest rates further, and it will push the longer-term rate of interest up just because there'll be more bonds sold and the expectation that more bonds will have to be sold. You know, everybody talks about how QE, when the Fed buys bonds, reduces interest rates. The same logic says that when the government sells bonds, it will increase interest rates.
What do you think about the corporate tax cut that's in this plan that would drop it down to 20%?
I think it's extremely expensive. I think it quite likely will ultimately have the effect of pushing capital investment offshore, because we move from the principle that U.S. companies pay taxes on all of their income to the principle that U.S. taxes companies only pay taxes primarily on their U.S. income. True, there is a global minimum tax contained in the proposal, but there are various ways of avoiding that global minimum tax. And so I think for many companies, the advantage of moving investment to Europe or moving investment to a tax haven will be increased by this proposal.
So you don't think that the current tax rate for corporations is too high competitively around the world?
I think there's a case. I think this I could support and would support a proposal which brought down the corporate rate somewhat, not nearly as far as to 20%, did so in a way that was revenue neutral, paid for by closing a range of corporate sheltering opportunities, crack down on income that avoided paying taxes through the use of tax havens. And a strategy of that kind, I believe, would be a prudent tax reform that would increase the efficiency of the economy and might even bring some investment home from abroad. But this tax reform is designed as a giveaway to the owners of old capital, those now earning monopoly profits, and those in the best position to exploit various kinds of what we call tax arbitrages that basically change the accounting without changing the reality so as to reduce total taxation.
How concerned are you about the elimination of the state and local tax breaks in this plan, which help people in high tax states like New Jersey, New York, Connecticut, and California? They'd be the ones who would be hurt by this plan.
I think that's a value judgment. On balance, my judgment would be that those provisions are ill-advised because they'll make it more difficult to provide some of the most generous benefits that our country provides and provide some of the kinds of public goods like the New York Library that are provided in our leading cities and states. But that's an issue where reasonable people could differ, unlike some of the corporate tax issues where I think it's pretty clear that what's envisioned here is just a giveaway to special interests.
Are there any parts of this plan that you've seen so far that you like?
I like the concept that we're going to have tax reform, even if I don't like the details. And I like the idea of an expansion of the child credit. That's why I'm so sorry to see the budget gimmicks contained in the plan that cause it to help lower and middle income families in the first year, but then cause those benefits to be removed very quickly over the next half dozen years, whereas the breaks for rich people mushroom over time, with, for example, the magnitude of the estate tax cuts growing towards total elimination in 6 years.
Do you think that something close to what we've seen is going to pass?
I certainly hope not. I certainly hope that Congress will do its congressional and constitutional duty, and that if something passes, it will be really quite different from the current proposals.
As we've been watching the debate over tax cuts in Washington, we've also been watching the stock market rally to record levels. Do you think, number one, that those two things are connected, and number two, that this rally is in trouble, especially if there is no tax reform package?
I know better than to predict the stock market. My sense, based on what I hear from those who trade the stock market, and based on looking at different companies, those that are most affected by tax reform and those that would be much less affected by tax reform, is the tax reform is at most a minor factor explaining movements in the stock market.
One more thing, Larry Summers, while we have you. What do you think of President Trump's pick to head the Federal Reserve, Jerome Powell?
Well, I first want to say that I think the country should be grateful to Janet Yellen for the superb job she has done as a public servant over many, many years at the Council of Economic Advisors, at the San Francisco Fed, as vice chairman of the Fed, and especially as chairman of the Fed for these last 4 years. I've known Jay Powell a long time. He's a very honorable, very thoughtful person who has now been immersed in the work of the Federal Reserve for 5 years. And I think he has every potential to carry on the very good work that Janet Yellen has done.
You think his tenure will be almost like a continuation of Yellen, or will it be different?
Yeah, I think every Fed chair finds their own way. And I would be surprised if there were not some significant events. I don't know what they'll be, a major move in markets or a decline in the economy into recession or an international event that will be defining of Jay Powell's term. And so I'd be surprised if when historians look back, they simply see it as a period of continuity, not so much because his policy preferences are profoundly different from Janet Yellen's, than because I think the economic environment rarely stands still.
Are you worried about a recession right now?
I'm not worried for the very near term, but I am worried that recessions do come, probably a 20% a year chance of recessions coming. And traditionally, our nation's anti-recession strategy has been a 5 percentage point cut in the federal funds rate, the Federal Reserve's interest rate. And there's not likely to be anything like that amount of room when the next recession comes. And that suggests that we're in a more brittle economy than we're used to. And I'm not sure that brittleness is something that's been fully taken on board. And it seems to me that when Chairman Powell thinks about monetary policy strategy issues, that question of what will monetary policy's capacity to respond to the next recession be has to loom very large.
That's former U.S. Treasury Secretary Larry Summers. Thanks so much, as always, for joining us.
Good to be with you.
One of many voices on the Republican tax cut plan. We'll be hearing from more, and you can listen to our other conversations at hereandnow.org.
And it's open enrollment time for folks looking to buy health insurance for next year. Now, most people keep their plans by default and don't bother investigating options, but could they be leaving money on the table? Joining us now with more is Jill Schlesinger, host of Jill on Money and the podcast Better Off. Hi there, Jill.
Hello.
It's good to talk with you. So let's start with those 151 million Americans who get their insurance through employer-based plans. Should they be seeking other options?
Well, you know what? You've got to review your plan. Your employer has been reviewing their options. They've been switching things up. So here's what you have to start with. What did I spend in the previous year on my healthcare costs? You say my insurance costs plus my out-of-pocket. Then you want to project what your healthcare costs could be in the year ahead. I know sort of unknown, but you know certain things. Compare the plans, determine what they cover, how much they cost. Don't forget the co-pays and the deductibles, and whether or not your doctors are in the network.
I see. And as for those co-pays and deductibles, they seem to be getting ever higher. I mean, how do some of those costs, like premiums, compare to last year?
Well, you know, it's interesting. The pace of premium increases is actually slowing down. That's according to the Kaiser Family Foundation survey. They found in 2017, we saw premiums up by 3% from last year. Workers pay about $5,700 towards the cost of their coverage. Unfortunately, our contribution to premiums, it's increasing more rapidly than the employer's share. And as you said, the out-of-pocket, that's really where we're getting hit hard. That's going up much more quickly than the actual premium cost.
Okay. So in terms of like being sort of penny wise about your net costs for next year, should people be looking to set up up, health savings accounts or flexible savings accounts?
Well, I love these health savings accounts. They're usually paired with something called a high deductible health plan. And there's rules about what is actually defined as a high deductible plan. But the cool thing is that it is what it sounds like. You have a high deductible and you have lower premiums. And they're paired with something called a health savings account that can help pay for higher deductibles with lots of great tax advantages, because those HSA contributions, they're either pre-tax or tax deductible. You control how they're invested, the earnings and the interest tax-free, withdrawals for the qualified medical expenses are tax-free. You can roll these over year after year, so this is really great. You should at least look at it. And if you don't have an HSA, yes, flexible spending accounts are great. They can be a very healthy option here. You can set aside $2,650 in pre-tax dollars for an individual for any out-of-pocket expenses. Remember, you can usually only carry over about $500 from one plan year to the next, so be careful how much you're setting aside.
I see. And since this is public radio, people are going to be like, you said penny wise, Meghna, and penny wise and pound foolish. That is not what I meant. I did not mean that. But just be smart about your money. That's why we're talking
right
to Jill. All right, so last question for you, Jill, because we do need to talk about the 10 million or so people who get their health insurance through the Affordable Care Act exchanges. What should they be thinking about?
Well, you know, the enrollment period's cut in half. It's only running through December 15th. That's for the 39 states that use healthcare.gov. Remember, if your state has its own exchange, it may have its own deadline as well. This is going to be more expensive this year, but don't forget, 80% of healthcare.gov customers do get subsidies that lower the premiums. Be sure that you fill out these forms carefully, and know healthcare.gov is going to be shut down from midnight until noon on most Sundays during enrollment period. If you need help, there are several nonprofits that are providing guidance. One that I found really helpful is called Get America Covered. You may want to check that out to help you out.
Jill Schlesinger, host of Jill on Money and the podcast Better Off. Thanks as always, Jill.
Great to be with you.
It is time now for the Here and Now DJ Sessions. Julie Lavender is a jazz musician and host of the public radio show Dream Farm Radio, which brings jazz musicians to perform at her renovated barn in Hollis, New Hampshire. Julie, welcome back.
Hey, it's great to be here. Thank you.
And let's hear some of the music that you brought us. This is a trio led by harmonica player Roni Eitan with guitarist Shakar El Natan and percussionist Keita Agawa. This is the song King's Highway. Now, the instrument that sounds kind of like a kazoo is actually...
Don't say that to Roni.
Right. Well, it's a microtonal harmonica. What is that?
Check it out. Now, look, I'm not an expert. I'm just fascinated. Okay, so this there's a series of instruments I'm becoming aware of that are called microtonal instruments. So microtones are any different pitch that is distinctly smaller than a semitone in your basic Western scale. So if you divide the regular scale that we're aware of up into the octaves into 12 parts, microtones are actually smaller divisions. Huh. And to my ear, sometimes they might sound like somebody bending a note in a blues riff, but they're actually separate notes. And that carries so many implications, it makes my head explode. But you can hear the sound of that when Roni plays this microtonal harmonica built just for him.
And there's a world music sound in here as well. Where are these guys finding their influences?
Well, Roni and Shakar are from Israel, and I'm not exactly sure where Keita is. But yeah, you've got North Africa, Andalusia, and Israel, and beyond.
Hmm. Well, up next we have Max Ridley's Basement Show Philharmonic performing the Johnny Mercer song, Dreams. Tell us about this one.
Well, you might be wondering why I included this. It's because it's an example of synergy jazz, which is what we do, which is lots of influences that play well in the sandbox with jazz and jazz musicians. And so here what you've got is a very inventive bass player and composer that has a group that features violin, voice, trumpet, sax, drums, harp, bass, space machine, and feet, because he often collaborates with a fellow named Ian Berg, who tap dances through his music. I don't know if you could hear that tapping sound,
yeah.
But they're actually using the feet as an instrument, and it's super fun to have all of these things kind of unfolding in one piece, you know, right there in the barn, kind of blowing my mind. But they also are so serious about bringing all these different influences into a jazz standard or a personal composition.
And what is a basement show philharmonic?
Well, I think that's his, you know, his wink and nod humor toward a group of musicians that can't wait to get together and develop new things in his basement. And I heard it and I thought, well, then come to my barn. So we actually called the show like the Barn Philharmonic. Super fun, super fun.
Barns and basements, they're kind of like each other.
Right. I didn't have a garage band phase, so it's a barn phase for me.
All right, well, let's hear some more. This is the piece Inseguranza from the Makayu Chamber Jazz Trio. You can hear some Thelonious Monk in there, some classic jazz trio sounds, but what else are you hearing in this piece?
Well, they've got Eastern Europe going on down there. They've got they're fantastic classical players. Maxim Lubarsky is on the piano, Catherine Bentz on the cello, and Yulia Musayelyan. She's the flautist, and she is also the band leader and a fabulous composer. All of them are. And so they have a discipline that is really stunning, but also they really have the freedom to improvise so beautifully that they soar and flutter across any landscape of whether it's jazz voicings, classical voicings, or folkloric traditions. They've got it all going down. And you can hear there's sort of a refined excellence as well as playfulness in everything that they do.
How did you find them?
Well, I love the work of Maxim Lubarsky. He's been on my program a number of times, and he actually collaborated on some of my work. And so I keep my ear to the ground whenever I hear he's doing anything. And then through him, I met Catherine Bent, who's been on the program with her Brazilian music trio. And then Yulia is a new friend for me, and what a treat.
Okay, well, next we have a medley of songs from the Venezuelan Project. Now, this is a group of recent immigrants to the United States. Tell us more about the Venezuelan project.
What intrigued me was the instrumentation. Eduardo Betancourt plays the Venezuelan harp. It's prominently featured, and it's just gorgeous sound. Then we've got Carlos Capacho on the cuatro, which is the best of guitar and ukulele all rolled into one fabulous little instrument. You've got Josu Ortiz on piano, Ali Tovar on bass, and Alexis Soto on percussion. So you have Latin jazz sounds and the uniqueness of their instruments that I think are really charming and captivating. So there's a total win here with these guys.
And this is a medley, so the song shifts entirely about halfway through.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's three things you're going to hear. Merenguisimo by Josu Ortiz, Blue Ensemble by Carlos Capacho, and Pajarillo, which is a Venezuelan folk song.
What is it about being in a barn that changes the music, or does it?
Well, I'll tell you what. You know, this barn was renovated, and before we arrived, it's got these, I mean, literally soaring posts and beams in this huge upper level. And so the musicians would be downstairs, and we would have all neighbors and friends crammed in and children hanging over the banisters. And in between songs, I would interrupt, and I would say, ask your questions. And the people who would think they didn't like jazz would be asking these jazz musicians about what they did and how they did it. And people that I know behind the scenes who were sharing their art and music were opening up in a way that they wouldn't have if it was just another gig somewhere where no one cared, where family wasn't present, and where they were just oral wallpaper, you know? And so at the barn, we stop, we listen, and we break it down so that art is accessible, music's accessible.
That's Julie Lavender, a jazz musician and host of the public radio show Dream Farm Radio. Julie, thanks as always.
Thank you.
And you can hear all of our DJ session picks at hereandnow.org.
President Donald Trump recently told Utah lawmakers that the Bears Ears National Monument, designated in the waning days of the Obama administration, would be downsized. Now, that message is in line with recommendations from Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke. Like Trump, Zinke favors boosting production of oil and gas resources on federal lands to create jobs and enhance the nation's energy security. Zinke also says he's both an avid outdoorsman and a follower of the conservation ideals of Theodore Roosevelt. Inside Energy's Dan Boyce takes a look at how Zinke's views actually stack up to those of America's 26th president.
Pretty much any chance he gets, Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke brings up his idol.
Up front, I'm a Teddy Roosevelt guy.
Teddy Roosevelt had the courage 100 years ago. The reorganization is going to be bold and look at just as Teddy Roosevelt did.
And if the manager of most of our federal lands is going to take after anybody, it's hard to find a more appropriate inspiration.
Roosevelt is generally regarded as the father of the modern conservation movement.
This is Whit Fosberg. He's president and CEO of the Theodore Roosevelt Conservation Partnership.
When he was president, he set aside somewhere around 230 million acres of public lands for the future of people forever.
That's larger than the states of Texas and Wyoming combined. It includes 150 national forests, 5 national parks, 51 wildlife refuges, 4 national game preserves, and 18 national monuments. Zinke often pays his respects to that legacy while still pushing the pro-industry line of the Trump administration. Here he is earlier this year at an event called Unleashing American Energy.
Our public lands are unique on this globe. We want to make sure we protect them, cultivate them, but you can use them wisely.
Reporter Michael Doyle covers the interior for E&E News in Washington, D.C. It's an energy and environment news organization. He says this is all part of Zinke's agenda.
Very explicitly part of his agenda to open up the public lands to greater use under the theory that they belong to the public for multiple use.
This is an ideological struggle over public lands that goes back at least to Roosevelt. The country's different land designations, whether national park or wilderness area or whatever, all have different rules. Let's call it a conservation spectrum. On one end, you have multiple-use lands, like national forests, that allow timber harvests or energy development, with the understanding those lands will eventually be left in good condition. On the other end of the spectrum would be lands managed for preservation, like national parks, the goal being to keep those places as close to their natural state as possible. Roosevelt believed in that entire spectrum and designated lands accordingly. And in that way, Michael Doyle says Zinke does take after Roosevelt.
Secretary Zinke, he has complicated, nuanced views, even if at the same time, industry is probably going to win more battles in his department than it loses.
Zinke's department recently unveiled a controversial plan to double some entrance fees to help shore up a major budget shortfall for the national parks. Also, he's been traveling around the country visiting parks to increase their exposure. Still, perhaps the most criticized move of the new secretary's tenure has been his recommendations to shrink the size of at least 4 national monuments, possibly opening some of that land to fossil fuel development. If the recent news on Bears Ears is any indication, they're recommendations the president intends to follow. Now, the law creating national monuments was signed by none other than Theodore Roosevelt. Here's the Sierra Club's Dan Ritzman.
It's terribly ironic that we have somebody who likes to call up the name and compare himself to Teddy Roosevelt. But the major thing that he has done in his 9 months as Secretary of the Interior is try to undo this act that was signed by Roosevelt and to strip protections away from places that were protected using this act.
Zinke argues the original law says monuments should set aside the smallest amount of land possible to protect sites of national interest. He says the monuments he recommends shrinking do not follow the spirit of that law. However, in his recommendations to President Trump, Zinke also suggests establishing 3 new national monuments in Kentucky, Mississippi, and Zinke's home state of Montana. The White House says the president will travel to Utah to make a formal announcement about the Bears Ears Monument in December. For Here Now, I'm Dan Boyce.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.